And we are back with another episode of Gladio for Europe. I am Russian Sam, joined as always by my co-host Liam.
Hey!
And I don't know what to say except here it is. This is what you've all been waiting for. This is the big one. Gladio for Europe is finally beginning its Morocco series. It's come up already in a number of episodes, namely the Casablanca episodes and our Arabo-Norman episode. But we're launching this series to talk entirely about Moroccan history.
Those of you who follow us on Twitter might note that Russian Sam has done this really exciting work in republishing a book known as The Magnet by Ramon Sender, which describes the ways that Spanish imperial activity in Morocco paved the way for the eventual rise of fascism.
Yeah, The Magnet really tells the story of the disaster of Anual, which was the single bloodiest defeat dealt to a colonial army fighting a war against the people whom they hoped to subjugate. The Magnet follows one of these soldiers, a Spanish conscript, as he makes his escape and covers the brutality of the war in gruesome detail, the stupidity of the Spanish army, and drawing parallels between these Spanish conscripts who were literally only there because they didn't have enough money to be stationed on the peninsula for their military service, and the people who they were sent to subjugate.
Right. And so as we were looking into this topic, we realized that it made a lot of sense to not only describe the way that Spanish experiences in Morocco led to developments in Europe, but that Morocco really deserves to be understood on its own terms, because traditionally, so much of the discussion about Moroccan history really only focuses on interactions between Moroccans and Europeans. Events like the conquest of Spain by the Muslims, the Barbary War, or, as the book The Magnet describes, French and Spanish imperial incursions into Morocco. This is all really, really important, and this podcast series is going to explain how all of those events happened. But we really want to get into Morocco on Moroccan terms, basically, because Morocco is so much more than its history of interactions with Europe. But at the same time, because it's right next to Europe, this kind of interaction is totally ubiquitous.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Moroccan history is just vast, incredibly vast. So this week's episode, we're just going to be doing a crash course on Moroccan history with a particular focus on the formation of the Moroccan kingdom in the Middle Ages, as well as the eventual formation of the dynasty which currently rules Morocco, the Alawis. Morocco is full of amazing stories across all of its periods, and we hope to cover some of our favorites in this series of episodes. But in a sense, we're going to be going right back to the beginning. One can say that Morocco is where all of our stories began.
In 1960, a Moroccan miner working at the site of Jebel Irhoud, an hour outside Casablanca, made a fascinating discovery. It was a skull, clearly human or at least humanoid, embedded in a deposit of limestone. A local team of French and Moroccan archaeologists combed the entire area and decided that the physical features and style of the flint tools nearby were most consistent with Neanderthals, probably from about 40,000 years ago. But further excavations at Jebel Irhoud in the 90s revealed even more bones in the same layer of soil. But these bones weren't any kind of hominid. They were Pleistocene mammals that had been hunted to extinction in Morocco more than 100,000 years ago, far earlier than the previous date of 40,000 years ago. It was also determined that this skull wasn't a Neanderthal, but instead belonged to a Homo sapiens, one of us, an anatomically modern human that happened to have some vaguely Neanderthal features, like a weak jaw and a heavy brow. This was a big deal, because up until this point, it actually wasn't known that Homo sapiens had migrated out of Africa so early, but even later research would push that date far beyond 100,000 years, all the way to 300,000 years. Once a new system of thermoluminescent dating was used to determine the age of these tools and the fossils with much more accuracy than before. Turns out, the skull at Jebel Irhoud was more than 300,000 years old, therefore not only the oldest Homo sapiens skull found outside East Africa, where we know humans most likely developed, but in fact, the oldest anatomically modern fossil ever discovered. This means that this Moroccan discovery completely rewrote our history of our earliest past, pushing back the date of human origins even further beyond 300,000 BC. This also shows that very early humans were not limited to their point of origin in East Africa, but instead were capable of wandering many thousands of miles, most likely even reaching the Atlantic Ocean itself.
The person who died at Jebel Erhud 315,000 years ago isn't really directly relevant to our story, but his existence serves as a potent metaphor for Morocco's simultaneous centrality and obscurity to world history. I would go as far as to argue that Morocco is the most important place in the Mediterranean that you've barely ever heard of, and over the course of this series, I'll be presenting my case with the help of my good friend Liam here, and with that being said, let's jump to a point where we can actually begin to build a narrative.
All right, so unfortunately, we don't know too much about the subsequent 300,000 years after Jebel Erhud, but we know that North Africa was always an amazingly dynamic place. A lot of our listeners already know that 15,000 years ago, at the end of the last ice age, the northern half of Africa was nothing like the largely arid region it is today. This period, which we call the Green Sahara, lasted about 10,000 years up until around 5000 BC, and corresponded with huge changes in human population history. It also corresponded with the emergence of some of the earliest human, urban, and agricultural civilizations across East Africa and Egypt. Hunter-gatherers and eventually tribal herdsmen moved across the Green Sahara, allowing for direct contact for the first time between groups originating in sub-Saharan Africa and groups from the Middle East. These interactions laid the basis for the modern population structure of North Africa, but you'd have a lot of constant migrations from elsewhere and from different parts of Africa, basically up until the present. Some historical linguists think that Afro-Asiatic languages like Amazigh and Hausa might have initially spread out of Africa to other parts of the continent during this period, but the jury's still out. Another interesting aspect of the Green Sahara period is that we start to see for the first time new interactions between North Africa and Iberia, you know, Spain and Portugal, just across the Straits of Gibraltar. These connections are basically never going to go away after the Green Sahara period, and like we said at the start, we don't want the series to focus on European and Moroccan interactions, but because Morocco and Spain are so close, you really can't avoid them.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you can actually swim from Morocco to Spain without that much effort.
Yeah, actually, you're right. And, you know, hundreds of people have done this since the 20s. Yeah, so maybe that'll be our next project. You know, after we get this book published, we can make the swim. Probably the most interesting of all of these kind of, you know, trans-Gibraltaran cultures, whatever you want to call them, would be the Capsian, which were these hunter-gatherers who migrated to Spain out of Morocco right at the end of the Green Sahara period. Some people think they might have brought some kinds of new agriculture or at least herding practices to Iberia, but it's not that well-developed of a field. We know that they had some kind of influence on the area. We also know, interestingly, that they were genetically related to the Natufians, who were potentially the very first agriculturalists in the Near East. So this shows that as early as like 5000 BC, a lot of really dynamic population movements all across Africa.
Wow, they were related to the Natufians. Would they have gotten from Spain all the way to the Near East and become the Natufians?
I think it's more like they're distant cousins, you know. I would probably guess that, you know, yeah, one group goes east into the Near East, one group goes west toward Morocco and Spain. But there's definitely some kind of a surprising link there. Probably a more concrete Near Eastern connection would be the Cardialware culture, which I think we might have touched on like once before in one of our really early episodes, because these guys were an Anatolian farmer population who actually are most famous for bringing agriculture to Europe for the first time. As they went along the entire northern half of the Mediterranean, some of them somehow slowly made their way to North Africa as well. These guys probably introduced modern agricultural practices to North Africa, and in return, you start seeing African goods like ostrich eggs popping up in Neolithic graves in Spain and Portugal. And the last movement across the straits we want to talk about in the prehistoric era would be the Bell Beaker people. We've definitely mentioned these guys before, I believe all the way back in our episodes on migration and memory, one of our first. We've gone all over the Beakers before. All you need to know is that they were a group of Bronze Age Indo-European-speaking farmers who might have originated in northern Spain and migrated all across Western Europe. Interestingly, they also established some kind of a presence in North Africa. While the Beaker people are most famous for leaving this huge genetic mark in parts of Europe, in North Africa, they really mostly seem to have left the Beakers themselves. These are the strange ceramic jars that they're named after. We don't really know what these jars were for, but they had some kind of huge significance, either economic or religious, to the people who made them. Because you start seeing these jars in these graves all across Western Europe, and again, for the first time now, even in parts of North Africa. One interesting fact they dug up was that there are actually some similarities between these bell beaker jars and earlier pottery produced in Morocco. So if this culture did form in Spain, then it's somewhat plausible that the famous jars themselves could have been a product of long-term interactions across Europe and Africa. But that's all the prehistory today, I promise. Now things can get a lot more interesting, because about 1,000 years after the bell beakers, Morocco finally enters the historical record with the Phoenicians. These are guys from modern-day Lebanon who established maritime colonies all over North Africa. The most important of these was famously Carthage, which, you know, became a great empire and actually still survives today as a suburb of Tunis, capital of Tunisia.
Yeah, Carthage would really take on a life of its own and grow out into a massive Punic-speaking Carthaginian empire, which had a huge foothold all over the Mediterranean, as well as in Iberia and Morocco, and which was at one point vying with Rome to see who would become the superpower of the Mediterranean. And I believe we touched on this on the Casablanca episode, but the Carthaginians seemed to have established the first permanent seaports anywhere in the Atlantic. And we know all this because the Phoenicians were illiterate people, and they contributed to our earliest canon of recorded history, although unfortunately most of what remains today are just lithic inscriptions rather than their books, because the Romans were very meticulous in destroying any trace of Carthaginian cultures.
Yeah, and that's famously where, you know, salt of the earth allegedly comes from. Yeah, so we mentioned that the Carthaginians were Punic-speaking, and Punic, or Phoenician, is a Semitic language. It was super close to Hebrew, almost identical to what I understand, and not that far off from Arabic. It also famously had a phonetic writing system. You know, that word comes from Phoenicia. And this would end up being the basis for all of the alphabets in the Middle East and Europe today. But although the rulers of the Carthaginian Empire spoke Phoenician, or Punic, the various indigenous peoples of the region spoke Tamazight languages, better known today by the somewhat derogatory catch-all term Berber, which is very distantly related to Punic and Arabic, but not really discernibly similar to anyone who's not a professional linguist.
Yeah, in the same way as English and Bengali are both Indo-European languages, and so they're related going 4,000 years back, this seems to be a similar connection there between the Semitic languages and the Tamazight languages writ large.
Although this link is actually probably many thousands of years even older than the Indo-European connection. You know, it's part of the Afro-Asiatic family, which is easily the oldest family that can be clearly demonstrated. Which just, again, just goes to show that, like, there's always been so much movement across this continent that 8,000, 10,000 years ago, you have peoples speaking related languages going as far out as the Atlantic coast of Africa and, you know, the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Peninsula.
Yeah, so the Phoenician language, although it was the language of commerce, it didn't really have much of a foothold outside of the cities, although some vocabulary did make it out into the languages that would have been spoken into the countryside. And so eventually this language would be replaced by Latin as the language of trade and government as the Roman Empire rolled in. But Carthaginian rule over Morocco left a legacy of this very intricate set of relationships between the urban and rural peoples that are going to be totally essential going forward to understand the entirety of Moroccan history.
Right, because the Carthaginians would eventually be replaced by a new set of Roman rulers who would then give way to a brief period of Germanic-speaking barbarian rulers, and then you get the much more impactful invasion by Arab Muslims in the 8th century. During all of these periods, the tribal and oftentimes nomadic Tamazight peoples of North Africa would be introduced to a state-oriented approach to rule, which didn't really seem to exist before the Carthaginians first got there. You start to see independent kingdoms being formed by Berber peoples under foreign influence, like, for instance, the Hellenized Numidians and the Mauritanians. The second group is pretty important because they actually gave us the word Maori in Latin, or Moor in English, which is a very confusing catch-all used by Europeans to refer to all Muslims, all North Africans, or even all dark-skinned people in general. Very confusing. It's a terrible word for that reason. But regardless, this starts to show that interactions between the Roman Empire and these indigenous Berber peoples would have really interesting implications on the kind of intellectual world of Europe and the perception that Europeans would have, or perhaps misperceptions, of their neighbors across the Mediterranean. However, Roman rule wouldn't last in North Africa forever, because during the crisis of the 3rd century, most of the interior would slip away from Roman control and local forces would regain their authority.
Yeah, so some variant of Moorish identity, and I say Moorish in quotation marks here because I doubt that this would have been a consistent thing that people would be identifying with in terms of like the actual values and practices. But regardless, people were continuing to call them Moors all the way until the 20th century, really. The novel I'm translating it is the default word to refer to the people of Morocco. So it really left its mark.
Yeah. And then like, Moro in Spanish it's a very common surname today. And it's just a kind of a catch-all used to describe all Muslims who ever lived in Spain, even those who might have had, you know, entirely Middle Eastern origins with no direct connection to North Africa.
Yeah. But for our purposes today, we're going to start with the Muslim Umayyads. The Amazigh tribes across North Africa would fiercely resist the Arabs, who were yet another set of Semitic-speaking invaders whom they had to contend with. And if any of you have heard anything about this period, then there's no doubt that you've heard about the Queen Kahina, or as she would have been known in her own language, Dihya, who was this semi-legendary Jewish queen who led the resistance against the Arabs in a similar way to Boudica, I would say.
Right, yeah, Kahina, who is not to be confused with a certain notorious Twitter user.
Oh yeah, very different woman.
Yeah, by the early years of the 8th century, Morocco would eventually be subdued and its people would be Islamicized, but almost immediately after, Berber tribes would be recruited to take part in the Islamic conquest of Iberia, which again, it's just a few miles away from Morocco. The leader, Tariq ibn Ziyad, was probably of Berber descent himself, and would lead one of the most important crossings of the Straits ever. Because with his army of Arabs and Berbers, that probably also included some residual Latin speakers, they cut through the Visigothic kingdom of Spain like a knife through butter. These Berbers, who had seemed so fierce in their resistance, were now loyal soldiers of the Caliphate. Or at least, it seemed that way at the time.
Yeah, so let's pause here for a second to explain the difference between Berbers and Arabs across North Africa, because this is really an incredibly complicated topic, and it's something that's bound to get you into a lot of very heated discussions if you're not careful.
Absolutely, yeah. And because in Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia today, you're going to meet a lot of people who identify as Berbers rather than Arabs, but they only speak Arabic. You might also meet people who speak Berber, but they've got a really proud history of, you know, Arab descent, and they can potentially trace their ancestry all the way back to medieval Arab migrants. Today, after 1,300 years of intermixing and a slow but pretty successful campaign to spread the Arabic language, the distinction between Arabs and Berbers is now mostly a matter of politics and identity. It's not really a clear-cut cultural distinction, although some people, particularly outside of North Africa, might try to suggest otherwise.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And maybe to add to the irony a little bit, while doing research for this episode, we came across a genetic study which found that North Africans who identify as Berber might actually have slightly more Arab ancestry than North Africans who identify as Arab. Arab here being a person from the Arabian Peninsula. And in the context of Morocco, generally the way it skews is that people who are more urban, as a general rule, will tend to be more likely to identify as Arab, whereas people living in the Rif Mountains, for example, really rural area, would be far more likely to identify as Berber.
Right. And I gotta think this probably looks pretty similar to the same dynamics you saw in the Carthaginian era, in the Roman era. You know, it does kind of seem like that it's a divide more about lifestyle than about identity here.
It's kind of like how Tacitus seems to imply that Scythians and Germans and all these people, that these aren't really ethnicities with cultures per se, rather it's a way of life. So if a Germanic-speaking people were steppe nomads, for example, then they'd be Scythian regardless of their actual language.
Right. I think that's exactly it. Yeah. I also feel like you see kind of a similar thing with the word Bedouin in Near Eastern politics. You know, it's much more about identity rather than anything about language or religion. It's confusing, you know. And it's especially confusing because the idea of these permanent cultural or even racial distinctions between Arabs and Berbers are really mostly the product of 19th century European colonialism. Because European, especially French scholars working in North Africa, they had various complicated political reasons for wanting to divide the various populations of North Africa. They tried to draw out a fundamental permanent divide between Arabs, between dark-skinned Berbers, and between light-skinned Berbers, which in ways that could, you know, jibe with European ideas about racial superiority, as well as, you know, help justify the rule of the French over this complicated and divided population. Recent scholarship has looked at the ways that earlier works have actually been sort of distorted or mistranslated even by 19th century Europeans who saw references to this medieval divide in culture and lifestyle and projected something much more explicitly racial, more similar to the kind of racial political divide that existed between the Europeans and their own colonial subjects in the Americas, in Asia, and now in Africa.
Although it must be said, even though I think that there was a partially racial basis to these distinctions being drawn, it shouldn't be taken to mean that these are the same kinds of ideas of race that we have. So whereas, for example, in the American context, being black was governed by the one-drop rule, the idea of if any of your ancestors going back like 5-6 generations were black, then you're black. Here, it was much more a matter of who your father was.
Yeah. If anything, in North Africa, the one-drop rule would have existed in reverse, because if you had any kind of peninsular Arabic ancestry, at least in the Umayyad period, that was really important, because you could claim a more prestigious pedigree than other Berber-speaking peoples.
Yeah, so let's get back into the Umayyads. The period we're about to talk to next, keep in mind that this would have happened just a couple of decades after the conquest, when this distinction would have been much more real than it is today in the sense of like divergent ancestries and totally alien to each other peoples almost at this point. And this is also the period of time when the word Berber came about. It was directly borrowed from the same word in Greek and Latin, which was used to describe the various tribal subjects of these people. Basically, they thought that all non-Greek and non-Latin forms of speech just sounded like people saying bar, bar, bar over and over again. So that term came to apply to, you know, pretty much everyone from Chinese to Berbers.
Right. Yeah. And so for the Arabs themselves, they also apply this term to a whole variety of peoples, because intriguingly, you start seeing the word Berber to describe groups as disparate as the, you know, the tribes of mountain North Africa, like Kahina came from, and even a certain region of Somalia became known as Berbera, which I think still is today.
Yeah, although that being said, I have seen an alternative explanation for why the Amazigh people of North Africa are called Berbers, and it has to do with the fact that they were apparently very loquacious. They really loved to speak, so, you know, bar, bar, bar. Yeah, so this distinction, it was very, very real at the time, much more so than it is today, and it led to a sort of caste system within medieval North Africa and within the Umayyad world writ large, which meant that Arab descent was highly privileged, especially along the patrilineal line. And so Berbers who could claim a peninsular Arab heritage found themselves in a much better social position than their neighbors, which contributed to the slow spread of the Arabic language and identity across the region, and also a lot of fake lineages.
I'm sure, yeah, I know. Well, it's just like, you know, much more ludicrous is how in Europe you saw so many, you know, alleged claims of descent from ancient Rome or even from, like, the Bible. Like, you know, I think we've talked about before, British Israelism was a big thing in the early modern period. Around Shakespeare's time especially, you started seeing a lot of British writers claiming that the English were one of the 10, 12 tribes of Israel. And then among the Scots, actually, because they didn't want to be the same as the Brits, they said, oh, actually, we, the Scots, were Egyptian, which I think is very funny.
We were king's lady. Yeah, so now we're going to get into the part where these caste distinctions really made a difference. And that would be the so-called Berber Revolt, which began in 740. As many of our listeners no doubt know, the letter of the law in Islam basically preaches the unity of all Muslims, regardless of their origins. There's a famous hadith where the prophet says that the white Muslim is not superior over the black Muslim and vice versa, essentially. But at the during the period of the Umayyads, they had a very different idea. As they spread across the Near East and North Africa, Central Asia, and all those places, they carried with them these very rigid ideas of Arab chauvinism, which considered Islam to be the religion of the Arabs first and foremost.
Right. I think the thinking here, or at least the justification, was that because Allah chose to reveal himself to the Arabs must be his favorites. And so therefore, other ethnic groups chafed under their rule. You know, what I've also read is that around this time, non-Arab people said, oh, no, you guys got it wrong. The reason why Allah came to the Arabs is because they were the ones who were so sinful, they needed him most.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah. Well, because of this policy, though, understandably, there would be a lot of ethnic tensions across the vast Umayyad Empire, and eventually it would lead to its downfall. Because it's really hard to rule like a 99% Berber and, you know, Syriac population when you're insisting that Arabs are superior to others.
The Umayyads, who only a few years before had to deal with a succession crisis, which already left them in a weakened state, found that they were now faced with the so-called Abbasid revolution. These were all the non-Arab peoples, and as well as Arabs, who were unhappy that there was a central government getting involved with their lives. But the non-Arabs in particular, they were really unhappy that they were in a socially inferior position entirely because of their ancestry, despite the fact that they had already been Muslims for several generations. And so these non-Arabs, they formed the central constituency that rose up against Arab domination in 747 under the black banner of the Abbasids. But they weren't the first, surprisingly.
Right. Because in 740, the Berber revolt in North Africa broke out for basically the same reason. Berber Muslims found themselves discriminated against in the allocation of leadership roles. And even more humiliatingly, even though many of them had converted to Islam, they still had to pay the jizya tax, which was levied against non-Muslims.
So because of this, something really snapped and a conspiracy was made. And so there was an attempt made to overthrow the Umayyads all across North Africa and all the way into Iberia, from Tunis all the way until the northern reaches of Iberia. They were ahead of the curve here, clearly, and it didn't pay off because for the most part, these revolts were put down. But there was a notable exception. The territory of what is today Morocco was lost to the Caliphate.
So because of this, you start to see the peoples of Morocco become essentially independent. And this is quite important because Morocco would be formally independent of caliphal authority in ways that basically nobody else in the Muslim world would. So you have this kind of longer tradition of an independent culture and maybe some kind of proto-statehood, which seems to have some kind of impact on the ways that later Moroccan rulers would understand their own kingdom. It gave the Moroccan state, or at least what would become the Moroccan state, a lot more permanence and legitimacy than other territories we've talked about, like the Aghlabid Emirate of Sicily and Tunisia.
Yeah, so these Moroccan states, they would evolve alongside and with the heavy influence of other Muslim states, but for the most part, the people of Morocco really stayed their own course. And they would even give birth to a number of great empires in their own right. The first of which, although not exactly an empire, is very important in this history, and that was the Idrisid dynasty, which ruled from 788 to 974. This was the first dynasty which would cement control over most of the territory that made up Morocco, and this dynasty was named after a man named Amidris ibn Abdullah, who was an Arab descendant of the prophet who had launched his own rebellion against the Abbasids. For complicated reasons. But basically, there were a lot of people who weren't happy with the way the Abbasid revolution turns out. But the long and short of it is that the faction that Idris was a part of was defeated, but he was able to make his way to Morocco, where with the help of some local tribes, he was able to create a kingdom and consolidate his rule.
Right, and many other kingdoms and tribal confederations would arise in Morocco. For instance, you've got the Almoravids, who rose out of Morocco and captured much of Iberia, who were in turn replaced by the Almohads, we very briefly touched on in the Casablanca episode. These guys were interesting because they were a messianic movement led by a man named Ibn Tumart, who believed that he was the Mahdi, which is kind of a messianic figure within Islam. And after successfully waging a guerrilla war in the mountains for several years, he believed it was time to conquer the lowlands. However, this actually failed miserably. The Mahdi was dead, and many of his own followers were slaughtered, including the key military commanders. But perhaps miraculously, this terrible defeat only strengthened the resolve of his followers, who would go on to conquer their way all across Iberia and even as far as Tunisia.
Oh yeah, absolutely. This would have been the largest North African empire. But despite their spectacular beginnings, the dynasty died a really undignified death, slowly bleeding out as it lost its territories piece by piece, until finally the final caliph of the line controlled only the besieged city of Marrakesh, where he would meet his end at the hands of his own slave.
I feel like you gotta love medieval history, because like stories like that, that's kind of what keeps you coming back, you know?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It has a very Shakespearean quality to it. Yeah, so the dynasty that was besieging the city of Marrakesh were the new guys on the block. They were called the Marinids, and they basically inherited the Moroccan portions of the kingdom that the Almohads had consolidated. And although the area under their control was quite small compared to that of their predecessors, they were able to cement a really strong cultural foundation, which cemented many of the aspects of Morocco, which exist to this day, more or less through the period of imperialism. So after the interludes of the Almohads and their Mu'tazilite doctrine, which was actually a rationalist strain of Islam, which basically isn't something that you think of when you think messianic movement, but the Marinids, they turned back the clock, sort of. At least they said they turned back the clock. In reality, they just made Maliki Islam the official madhhab of the territory of Morocco, which basically means that within Sunni Islam, you have four main madhhabs, which are sort of like different schools of reasoning and jurisprudence, which are basically considered universally valid among Sunnis, even though they sometimes come to very different conclusions. It's just a matter of tradition, basically. But anyway, the Marinids, they really left a strong impression in the culture. Under their patronage, the city of Fes would flourish as a center of Islamic learning, and it would become the stronghold of an official Moroccan Islam, centered on the cities, as opposed to the more eclectic faith of the common people.
And this brings us back to the classic urban-rural divide that's going to underline really this entire series of episodes.
We've had to run through it, but now the moment you've all been waiting for, we're finally going to talk about the Alawis.
Right, because probably the most important dynasty for this episode and the entirety of Moroccan history are, like you said, the Alawis, sometimes known as the Alawites. This dynasty took the throne in 1631 and is actually still in power today, which is pretty remarkable, because this makes them not only the longest dynasty in Moroccan history and in North African history, but also makes them one of the oldest in the world today. You know, only a couple are older, and I think those, including the ruling dynasty of Japan, they're kind of on shakier genealogical footing than the kings of Morocco are.
The Alawis, they aren't just important because they're the longest ruling dynasty in the region. They're really important because the sultans of this dynasty would be responsible for forging what was then a medieval government into a modern state. Although not all of the reforms made by the Alawi sultans would be successful, these efforts would ensure that their realm was able to maintain its independence on paper during the turbulent early modern period when the majority of Africa came under direct European domination. And it meant that Morocco was able to take the form of a kingdom with distinct boundaries, an official identity that crosses ethnic and religious lines, although on the ground it's actually complicated.
Right, it's that classic urban-rural divide. But tell me, Sam, how exactly did these guys get started? And also, common question or misconception, is there any link at all between the Alawis of Morocco and the Alawi or Alawite or Alevi people of the Middle East? Any connection there?
Well, the connection there is that both of these forms are the adjective form of the name Ali, who was the son-in-law and cousin of the Prophet Muhammad. So both the Alawis of Morocco, as well as the religious sects, the Alawis and the Alevis of Turkey, claim to be connected to Ali, but in different ways. Whereas for the dynasty in Morocco, it's a genealogical connection. For the Alawis and Alevis in the Near East and Turkey, it's a religious connection.
So it's two different ways of sort of connecting yourself to the same Quranic figure.
Yes, exactly. Although not Quranic, no.
Oh, okay, but immediately following, yeah. Because, you know, because like so many North African powerful families, they claim descent from individual Arabs either mentioned in the Quran or very shortly after, especially in the Rashidun Caliphate, which was the first caliphate after the time of Muhammad.
Yeah, right. And again, a lot of these claims are really dubious because there were a lot of perks to being a descendant of the Prophet. But we're not going to delve on that. We're just going to take the dynasty at their word that they actually are descended from this guy. So like many other powerful North African dynasties, the Alawis claim descent from Ali, son-in-law of the Prophet Muhammad. By doing this, they were hoping to give themselves a sheen of both temporal and religious authority. In other words, I have the right to rule both because I am a descendant of the Prophet, but also because I am part of this line, which supposedly carries mythical powers, which is one of the things that, which sort of makes Moroccan Islam stand out against most other Sunni forms.
Yeah. And I think in general, there's a few things about the Morocco and the Alawis in particular that makes them stand out in the region and in the Islamic world at large. Like one thing I think is kind of funny is that they all go by the name Maule, which is, it's sometimes described as a name, but it's really just a title that they all happen to go by, which means my lord.
Yeah, exactly. So if you see a guy named Maule Abdullah or Maule Ibrahim, that guy's name isn't Ibrahim. That's just the title. That's just a way of signifying that he's a sultan. So because they claim this lordship, they have to have a legitimizing mechanism to explain that. And as I mentioned previously, they have their Sharifian descent from Ali, which is quite important, but in another case where Morocco is quite different from many of the other countries that make up the Arab world, you have a lot of emphasis here on two ideas, on jihad and the idea of berke. Yeah, so let's start with berke, which is the easier one of the two to explain. It literally means blessing, but transitively it refers to charisma. So by the time that we start our story, Morocco is already formally ruled by a largely Orthodox Sunni Islam of the Maliki school, as had been done by the Marinids, even though the history there is kind of shaky. It seems like the Idrisids were some kind of Shia. However, as we mentioned in our first Sicily episode, North Africa wasn't always like this. The Amazigh peoples largely chafed under this Orthodox Islam, which was sort of seen as a foreign imposition and very alien. So people who were parts of more heterodox forms of Islam found a really willing audience among these tribes. So the earliest example of this would have been the Kharijiyya, who in fact might have inspired the Berber revolt. And these were these very heterodox figures who basically assassinated the third caliph, Uthman, for supposedly having morally compromised himself and for not distributing the wealth from the expeditions of conquest equally among all Muslims. And even more out there, there was even some kind of Berber Islam with its own Quran written in the Berber language, which unfortunately has not survived to our day. I don't mean that like they translated the Quran into Berber. I mean like some guy wrote his own Quran.
So you're telling me it's like a Berber Mormonism.
Yeah, that's a great analogy, actually.
That's wild. In addition to this, another thing, like talking about different sects here, we should probably mention that although the Alawis and basically all of the groups we're talking about today have been Sunni, one of them was actually Shia, which was the Idrisids. Although I think that you pointed out, Sam, that as time went on, they seem to have kind of drifted away from Shiism.
From what I know about the history, and granted, I didn't look into this period super closely, but as I understand, these guys were probably some kind of Shiites, but then later dynasties like the Marinids would try to claim that they were in fact Sunnis.
Right, and you actually, I believe that's what happened with the, I want to say the Zirids also in Tunisia that you talked about in our Norman episode. The same kind of transition back to sort of this Sunni orthodoxy.
Yeah. At a certain point, Shiism, so-called, was really the wave of the Islamic world, especially in North Africa. You even had the Fatimid dynasty, as we mentioned previously, who were part of the Ismaili sect of Shiism, and whose caliphs claimed to also be imams, if I recall correctly. But that's really out of left field, so let's return back to Morocco.
And now that we're talking about Morocco, we're going to bring up, you guessed it, the urban-rural divide.
Yeah, so there's a quite strong bifurcation, which exists to some extent throughout the Islamic world. As a general rule, you have the sort of legalistic urban Islam of the cities, which is, you know, it's grouped into these madhhabs. It's about these guys, like, arguing about how many times you should bend over during prayer, for example, what time you can actually break your fast during Ramadan, those kinds of questions, something that in the Western world we're more likely to associate with Talmudic inquiry. But over there in the countryside, the people, they're not up for any of that nerd shit at all, really. So it gets a lot more colorful over there. In Morocco especially, you have this network of Sufi lodges called Zawiya, or Ziwaya in the plural form, which are led by these Murabit, which is a word derived from link, like a link between the worlds. Although originally, in fact, this would have been a military rank, but as I understand it, the idea of like a link between worlds also gained predominance after some time. But these Murabit, they were kind of like saints. Their graves would become sites of pilgrimage, much to the chagrin of more orthodox varieties of Islam. And they were often believed to have special powers, which is the aforementioned Bereka, which would be passed within the family line, and which would even stay with them after death, which is why a lot of people made pilgrimages to the graves of these people so that they can have an illness cured or have success in whatever ventures they're going on. Things of that nature.
Yeah. And, you know, something I find kind of interesting is that 19th century European writers who had very little direct experience with Islam, when they traveled to Morocco, they sort of misinterpreted what was going on here. And they thought that many different local clerics in Morocco who had a lot of baraka, they said, oh, this guy must be like the Pope of Islam. He's clearly so important. He must be the leader of the whole thing.
Yeah, and also many of them came with the idea of sainthood from Catholicism, where these people are like officially canonized or whatever, when for the most part, there isn't that kind of church hierarchy so-called within Sunni Islam. But in any case, just like the Murabit were expected to have Bereka, so were the sultans. So basically the body of the sultan, much like in Europe, would have literally been seen as sacred to the point where oftentimes you had sultans fighting against various tribes, and even though their faction was defeated and battled, they were still protected and kept in good conditions until they were sent back to the capital city because people just didn't want to hurt what they saw as a holy man.
Mm-hmm, that's interesting.
But this was kind of surface level, really. The urban clerics, the ulama, they were in some ways fundamentally at odds with the popular religion outside of their reach. At the same time, they couldn't really do anything about, because again, these are just like nerds hanging out in madrasas in cities like Fes and Marrakesh. What are they going to do about some Sufi lodge in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah. It seems like, you know, even though there's this perception, especially among Europeans and Westerners, that Islam is particularly rigid of a religion, it seems that in this period, there was a lot more religious orthodoxy happening in Christian Europe than in the Islamic world.
Yeah, well, some people tend to take basically the Islamic version of Puritans at their word way too much.
Right, yeah.
As I mentioned, the other major theme of Moroccan history is jihad, much more so than it was in most other early Muslim countries. And We have this very particular idea of jihad. You've often heard this idea of, like, there's the greater jihad and the lesser jihad, the greater jihad being your own internal spiritual struggles and the lesser jihad being actually taking up arms to fight for Islam. This is kind of overstated, although there's something to it, although it's not universally recognized. But in any case, in the Moroccan context, you had a lot of the actually militant sort of jihad as legitimizing ideology because of the close interconnectedness of Morocco with Iberia, which is something that you saw, like, from the earliest days, with the initial invasion being done largely by Berbers, and then through later dynasties like the Almoravids and the Almohads. And so because of that, there was a very strong connection to Iberia. So this ongoing process of Reconquista, it was a major cause for concern, much more than would have been in other Muslim countries, not just because these were co-religionists, but because these were your cousins.
And we should mention that both the Reconquista and these ongoing lesser jihads were both understood of in explicitly religious terms, which isn't necessarily true of other kinds of contacts and conflicts between Christians and Muslims in the Middle Ages. These were much more explicitly religious.
Yeah, so let's talk about how jihad became so important in the Moroccan context.
Right, and again, because, like, there's a stereotype that, you know, Islam is all about jihad, especially, like, among, you know, right-wing Americans, but that isn't really the case, except for these rare contexts like this one.
Yeah, it's important, but it's not, like, the sixth pillar of Islam, as you'll sometimes hear. But anyway, basically what had happened was that the notion of the caliphate, it became obsolete because there was really no longer a caliph after the Mongols had sacked Baghdad in 1252. And Moroccans were already not really digging the idea of submitting themselves to this caliph followed away in Baghdad. In fact, the Almohads, one of the things that really set them apart was that even while this Abbasid caliph was still officially there, they decided, yeah, we're a caliphate now, deal with it. But because there was no longer a caliph in Baghdad and the Medinids were now trying to transition Morocco back into the fold of mainstream Sunni Islam, as it would be understood in the rest of the Muslim world, they had to get really creative, and they found a great solution here.
What was that?
Well, let me quote from the book called Jihad and Its Interpretation in Pre-Colonial Morocco by Amamira Benison, who wrote, quote, "The Marinid sultans came to power in the mid-13th century in a post-caliphal age, but also understood that sultanic power needed to be legitimized by preservation of the faith in some form. One emotive religious ideal in the far west was that of jihad, the holy war to preserve Al-Andalus from Iberian Christian Reconquista. Ongoing Christian pressure on the Muslim frontier and attacks across the Straits of Gibraltar ensured that defense of Muslim land remained a crucial part of Western Muslim rulers' task to preserve the faith, and an important aspect of his legitimation. The task of preserving Islam in the Iberian Peninsula largely fell on the Nasrids of Granada, but the Marinids also endeavored to pose as fighters for the faith. Before they achieved power, they had distinguished themselves in the Battle of Alarcos of 1195, thereby gaining a reputation as holy warriors. On gaining power, within Morocco that is, they consolidated their position by publicly dedicating themselves to the holy war. One of the first acts of the early Marinid Sultan, Abu Yusuf, was to expel a Christian garrison from Saleh. In subsequent years, he drove the Castilians from Ceuta and directed four campaigns in Al-Andalus. Although Abu Yusuf's attack on Ceuta involved an alliance with Aragon, and his campaigns in Al-Andalus were often directed against the Nasrids as against the Castilians, courtly histories portrayed them as jihad fi sabilillah, a military endeavor in the service of God, and discreetly ignored the actions which contravened this image." So, in other words, while they were projecting this image of themselves as fierce jihadi warriors and expelling Christians, at the same time, they were also working with various Christian kingdoms when it suited their own interests.
It's very funny. Yeah. That's what state formation is. You know, it's like you're often basically talking out of both sides of your mouth. You're projecting a certain image while also making tons of ideological compromises to actually build the kind of state that image is going to support.
Yeah. And although the Medinids, they started to adapt this image in the 12th century before they even came to power, this issue took on a much greater importance in the 15th century and onwards. Because as Spain and Portugal cohered into more or less the same shape as they are now, there were increasing attempts to capture North Africa.
Right. And which I think is a really kind of interesting parallel here. You have the Moroccan and the Spanish kingdoms basically coming together in the same time and using the same kind of rhetoric to solidify their rule.
Yeah. And one of these funny pieces of rhetoric, which came to be very important later on, was a throwaway line in the final testament of Queen Isabel of Aragon, who most famously, through her marriage to King Ferdinand of Castile, would fuse the two kingdoms together and give Peninsular Spain more or less the same shape that it has today. But anyway, in her final testament, which was directed at her successors explicitly, not like to the country in perpetuity, she basically beseeched her successors to, quote, be very obedient to the commandments of the Holy Mother Church and protectors and defenders of it as they are obliged, and that they do not cease in the conquest of Africa and to fight for the faith against the unbelievers.
And it's interesting. It's kind of like a Renaissance equivalent to the famous farewell addresses of certain presidents, you know, like Washington and Eisenhower leave the office with this, you know, mysterious advice and then leave these problems for their successors to solve.
Yeah, except this is even more cryptic because this was being brought up like 300 years later to justify various wars that Spain was undertaking in Morocco. So much more of a stretch.
And I guess the main effect of this, though, is that because of this, that whether or not it's from this particular line in her speech, in any case, Spain and Portugal would be involved in a lot more violent activity in North Africa from here on out. We've touched on this briefly in the Casablanca episode. And so because of that, protecting Morocco from these Christian Iberian incursions would become basically the main pastime of Moroccan rulers.
Yeah, so sort of the idea was that being unable to defend the land consistently would be a severe blow to a ruler's legitimacy, and failing time after time would almost certainly result in a rebellion until a new dynasty was installed. You can kind of compare this to the Mandate of Heaven as an interesting parallel, although not exactly the same. Which naturally leads one to ask, do these dynasties fall because they are unable to hold back the Iberians? Or do the lands fall into the hands of the Iberians because state capacity has degraded to the point where the Moroccans can no longer defend it?
Well, that's basically the classic question, you know? Like, we've talked a lot about the fall of Rome, and it's the same kind of paradox. It's really hard to tell whether internal or external threats lead to these problems. It's really hard. It almost might be too complicated to suss out any kind of direct causal relationship. External and internal threats are too interrelated.
Yeah, but in any case, there's a story about the Sa'adi dynasty, which is the one that preceded the Alawis. And as the official story goes, they were dealt a fatal blow by the fact that the Sultan had promised Moroccan land to the Spanish in exchange for Spanish troops to help him put down domestic rebellion. Like, clearly that might be much more of a post facto justification. The fact that he had to ask for the Spanish help in the first place means that he probably wasn't long for this world.
And, you know, we should also mention that as this period would go on, jihad would take a little bit more of an unscrupulous form in a lot of cases, in that the Moroccan sultans would start paying corsairs, you know, the famous Barbary pirates, who we'll bring up later in the episode, to attack Christian merchant ships unless the Moroccan crown paid a bribe. This would be an especially big problem in Algeria, but you start seeing it in modern-day Morocco as well.
Yeah, and these people would also raid the coasts of various European towns and take those people into slavery.
Oh, yeah, and this was huge. All these southern Italian towns were actually abandoned in this period, in the early modern era, just because there was too much of a threat of being kidnapped by pirates.
Yeah, and often right-wingers today will apply their own slant to this from a racial point of view. Like, see, people were taking white people into slavery because because they just hated white people. When in reality, these kinds of raiding expeditions were something that was practiced both by Christians and by Muslims. It wasn't really done with a racial characteristic in mind as much as, hey, those guys are infidels. We can enslave them, whatever.
Yeah, and you know, as we'll get into in this episode, Europeans absolutely did not suffer the brunt of the Islamic slave trade either. But you know, now I think this is the great time to move on to the Alawi dynasty themselves. Because we talked a lot about what they were, what they believed, what they called themselves. But Sam, where exactly did this dynasty come from?
So as I mentioned previously, they claim descent from Ali. But more directly, they're supposed to be the descendants of Arab migrants from the Arabian Peninsula, who moved to Morocco in the 13th century, allegedly because they were invited there to help make sure that fig crops are successful. Unfortunately, we don't know if their presence actually helped the figs to grow. But in any case, these people became the Sharifa, which is the plural form of Sharifs, of the area around Tafilet in southeastern Morocco. And consequently, they gained control of some very important caravan routes, especially the trans-Saharan ones. But in any case, from the turn of the 17th century, the Saadi dynasty was in really rough shape. It was facing immense internal strife. You had both plague and then civil war enveloping the country. And because of this, it sort of broke up into a warring states period type of deal where there were many different factions trying to capture the throne. So the last really successful sultan of the Saadi dynasty was a guy called Ahmed al-Mansur. And this was a very, very ambitious guy. Basically, his idea was that by this point, you had the Ottomans ruling from Constantinople. And although they did claim to be the caliphate, they weren't super strong about this claim. But in addition to that, they were also, rather unusually for the Islamic world, they didn't claim to have any descent from the Prophet Muhammad, which was sort of a big deal. It meant that these guys, they weren't sharifs, so they don't have like the magic sauce, basically. But also, more importantly, they're not Arabs. They don't have an Arab patrilineal line. So our buddy Ahmed al-Mansur, he got a little race sciencey on us, and he decided, hey, I could be caliph, you know? And he had a really elaborate scheme here. Basically, his idea was that he was going to expand his rule eastward as far as he could go. After all, the Almohads had gotten all the way to Tunis. Surely he could get even farther with some planning ahead of time. And he planned to do that by taking over Timbuktu, which was the source of a lot of gold and slaves and a lot of very important resources. So what Ahmed al-Mansur did was he basically marched his army south through the Sahara Desert into Timbuktu, and he, with heavy losses and having used up a lot of resources, he took the place. And so it seemed like now was the perfect time to start moving eastward, right? Well, as it turns out, real life isn't a video game. You can't just put in a cheat code to get unlimited manpower. At a certain point, you're just going to run out of fighting men. And so that happened. But to add insult to injury, it also meant that the royal coffers were now empty. And there was also now a plague in the land, which many Muslim jurists actually thought was a way for God to show his anger at Ahmed al-Mansur, because Timbuktu was a Muslim state, so you weren't really supposed to be going to war with these guys because they already followed Islam. So essentially, Ahmed al-Mansur, he kicks around for a few more years. He has a lot of really zany schemes. At one point, him and Queen Elizabeth of England are planning to invade the Spanish Peninsula and to divide up Spanish colonial holdings in the America. Of course, there aren't any Arabic-speaking countries in the Americas today, so we can safely conclude that this was not to be. But in any case, we're going to cover the story in a lot more detail later. Suffice it to say, to his Arab surprise, Ahmad al-Mansur died of plague in the year 1603, and following his death, there was a massive succession crisis, which wreaked havoc on Morocco.
And I guess this succession crisis is what finally brings the Alawi dynasty to the forefront here?
Oh, yeah. 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 So in the 1630s, you're still in this sort of warring states period. But in the 1630s, you have the progenitor of the Alawis, a guy named Ali al-Sharif, who became the emir of the area around the Ziz Valley, which is, again, in southeastern Morocco, really. Because he had the capacity to defend the area, and it was really a free-for-all, so you had all these guys raiding each other. So whoever was able to defend an area was able to lay claim over it. And so Ali, he ruled for a couple of years, but he was sent into exile after losing a power bid against another contender. But his son Muhammad would become his successor and was able to secure his release a few years later. And so the Alawis were able to slowly expand their footprint across the Middle Atlas Mountains, rising and grinding for several decades. But ultimately, Muhammad was not to see his children found the dynasty because he would be defeated by his own brother, Rashid, who would then go on to capture the city of Fes in 1666. At which point, the notables of the city swore a bay'ah to Rashid, a oath of loyalty, which made him the first Alawi Sultan of Morocco.
Right. So what this seems like to me is that all across Morocco, going back several centuries, there's this long-standing tradition of military service with the monarchy, especially military service against Christians in jihad. But then in recent years, with the Alawis, you have these guys coming from very humble beginnings and fighting their way to the top by fighting other Muslims and fighting their way to the top of the society. So it seems like this is a very militarized society, but the Alawis are arguably particularly militarized within this society. And I have to think that this probably has some interesting implications on the form that the Alawi kingdom would take.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And this also speaks to the concept of berekeh, because basically if they were able to do this despite coming from such humble beginnings, clearly they have God's favor. But also, they weren't really the first. Several of the dynasties that preceded them basically came to power in the same way. I believe the Sa'adis, as well as a number of other ones. But basically, this trend has not yet repeated. So in the meantime, the Alawis remain in power, as we mentioned at the top of the episode. But let's explain what the bay'ah is, the oath of allegiance.
It's like kind of like the homage that Christian rulers would pay in the Middle Ages, or what was it exactly?
So basically, the idea was that when a new sultan comes to the throne, like, he's not automatically understood by the lay people to be an unconditional ruler by virtue of his birthright. Although some clergy thought otherwise because these guys were very big on stability, but no one really cares what they think. But anyway, the capacity of the ruler is super important per the letter of the Sharia. And that basically means that if a sultan is not really good, then it's all right to rebel. It's all right to challenge him for the greater good. And so what this meant is that the bay'ah, which actually has its origins in commercial contracts, basically, it's basically like the idea is not that I support you unconditionally, but rather if you do XYZ, that means that you have my support. Yeah, so the bay'ah, it wasn't like a countrywide thing, really. Every community was going to swear its own bay'ah. Every city, every tribe, they all had to do it.
Yeah, which sounds, again, a lot like the kind of contracts that existed in the Christian world in Europe. These kinds of, like, there are agreements between people and between institutions rather than between a government, you know, and it's much more personal.
So here's an example of what might possibly happen if your subjects one day decided that that you're not meeting the conditions of the bay'ah that they had sworn to you.
The bay'ah of Moulay Ismail's son, Abdallah, went, "We have given you the bay'ah, and we have given you power in order that you may direct us with justice and blessing, with fidelity and truth, that you should judge between us with justice." Abdullah did not fulfill those conditions. Hence,
the notables met together and conferred about the position and that of the Sultan. They brought a copy of the bayah and scrutinized its conditions. They said, "We did not give him the bayah so he could deal with us in this way." Then they announced that he was going to be deposed. This was easy to do because the Sultan was weak, and it was easy to justify, because weak sultans could not protect the Dar al-Islam, the House of Islam. It was much harder to justify and much more dangerous when the Sultan was strong. And that's from Pennell's Morocco History. So yeah, so in a sense, I guess, it's this kind of contract, the sort of, you know, it's like the Chinese Mandate of Heaven. It gives a pretext for the nobility to overthrow whatever kind of monarch might be ineffectual. And, you know, because hereditary monarchies produce so many ineffectual monarchs, this might have been pretty effective.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But at a certain point, it became very counterproductive. But we'll get to that. But in any case, Rashid, he was able to take Marrakesh in 1668. And Fes and Marrakesh, these were the two main poles of Moroccan politics up until that point. Fes more towards the north, Marrakesh towards the south. And sultans, they would sort of divide their attention between these two capitals. But Rashid, he decided that he wasn't really a fan of either of these two cities. So instead, he made a new capital, the city of Meknes, which would become the third imperial capital. He had a special fondness for the city because this was the city that he was in charge of when his father was still around. So he had built up a bond with them.
Right. But sadly for Rashid, though, he wouldn't be able to rule any of these cities for very long because he would die just a few years after uniting both halves of Morocco.
Yeah, he died unexpectedly in 1672, rather embarrassingly, falling off his horse during a procession and hitting himself so hard that he just died. As a result of that, the next in line to the succession was his brother, Ismail, who had already been put in charge of administering the north. And because he was in this really favorable position, he was able to rush to claim the throne and seize the capital and the treasury before any of his competitors got there. And Ismail, he would be the longest serving sultan in Moroccan history, I believe, ruling from 1672 until 1727, an entire 55 years, which even today would be very impressive.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, yeah. That's what, like a golden jubilee. In any case, yeah, I understand that his reign was not only very long, but also understood as kind of a high watermark of the Alawi dynasty, right? Because they might not have known this at the time, but it was really all downhill after him.
And Ismail, he was really a strong man ruler with everything that entails. This idea of autocracy, Ismail was really Mr. Autocracy in many different ways. So perhaps the most chilling example of this would be his new professional army, who were called the Abid al-Bukhari, which means basically slaves or black people of Bukhari. And yes, they're being used synonymously in this sense. We'll get to why that was.
That's a little, ooh.
Yeah, and so this Abid al-Bukhari was composed of 80,000 soldiers at its height. That's a more realistic projection, although some sources have it at as high as 150,000.
No, but still, for an early modern army, that is enormous.
In some sense, he was continuing a well-worn tradition of recruiting troops with no ties other than to him to be the Sultan. This is what the Ottomans were doing when they set up the Janissary system.
Oh, of course, and we talked about in Norman's episode, the Aghlabids, our friend Emir Ibrahim, he had his slave army 1,000 years before this.
Yeah, absolutely. In any event, in this period of time, you basically had two options. You could depend on the troops levied by your nobility, which was the other thing that was usually done in Moroccan history. These were called jayush, which is just the Arabic word for army. And these would be levied from individual tribes in exchange for lands and tax exemptions. But this was kind of a problem because these people, they're part of this tribe. They have their own tribal interests. They have their own personal interests. And that just really interferes with things. So it's much easier to have a bunch of people who are directly loyal to you, hanging on your every word.
Right. I guess the only, the problem, though, with an army of slaves is that, number one, you're always going to be a little bit wary that somebody you forcefully enslaved is going to be ever actually that loyal to you. But number two, you also have to acquire all of these enslaved people.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way that Ismail went about doing this is absolutely horrific. So as the name implies, this was an army of black slaves, because black people were understood to be outside of the Moroccan tribal structure, although that wasn't entirely the case. And definitions of blackness are quite different from our own, as we'll see shortly.
Yeah, this is actually a very interesting ongoing field of scholarship, is kind of interrogating these medieval and early modern Islamic attitudes of race and slavery, and seeing to what extent they overlap or may have influenced or been influenced by much better known European ideals of slavery and race.
So the approach that Ismail decided to take was basically going around and forcefully enslaving every sub-Saharan African person that he could get his hands on to fill the ranks, both men and women, the men to be soldiers and the women to be concubines for those soldiers so they could keep pumping out children. And this idea of using specifically black slaves to build an army wasn't really new in Moroccan history, but this was unprecedented, really, because, again, this was just basically taking every person that you decide looks black, grabbing them off the street and saying, you're the personal slave of the Sultan now. You're going to serve in his army.
It must have been terrifying if you were a dark-skinned Moroccan person. And so were these slaves, were they captured from just towns in Morocco, or did they go into sub-Saharan Africa, into more southerly countries? Do you know how they did this?
It was a mix of both. You had large numbers of people who looked black because Morocco isn't that far from sub-Saharan Africa, so you would have had natural migratory exchanges. But more of these people would indeed be the descendants of slaves. So when Ahmed al-Mansur went down to Timbuktu, he took back with him a bunch of slaves. But slavery wasn't supposed to be hereditary in Islam the same way that it is in the Americas during the period of chattel slavery. It's kind of a different system in many ways. But the point was, by the time that Ismail got around to doing this, many of them were free because, you know, their ancestors had been slaves. But at this point, they could be found anywhere in Moroccan society, from the ranks of the Haritain, who were sort of like these sharecroppers, if you want to use an American analogy, all the way up to merchants and scholars and notables.
Right, and because of, you know, you mentioned that many black women were married or, you know, in some kind of sexual relationship with many high-status Moroccan men, a lot of very wealthy Moroccan individuals, even in the nobility, would have a lot of African ancestry.
Yeah, so this was indeed very controversial, and this caused the ulama to rise up against Ismail in as far as they could. But before you start talking about how moral they are for standing up for the rights of these people, keep in mind that the ulama, many of them would have been from notable families. So in practice, enslaving all the black people in Morocco would mean that your family was suddenly going to lose its slaves. So there might have been some self-interest there. But regardless, you weren't supposed to be enslaving Muslims. That was the entire thing. So here's a quote from the book Black Morocco by Shuki Al-Hamil.
Believing that they were free Muslims, Moroccan blacks were shocked at the way they were singled out and treated like slaves by government officials and protested this illegal procedure. Even among the slaves themselves, there were those who had established bonds with their masters and refused to leave their quarters. Al-Ilyesh agreed to accompany those who protested to the Supreme Judge's office, knowing very well that their fate had already been decided. The judge was actually the Sultan's collaborator in this affair. Consequently, Maulay Ismail commanded his officers to enslave all the black people, even those who were free.
Yeah, and when this was so controversial within Morocco among the ulama, what Ismail did was he wrote a letter to Al-Azhar, which is sort of like the most prestigious center of Islamic learning in Cairo, Egypt. And he laid out his case basically saying that, oh, you know, these people are all really slaves fundamentally because, I mean, even though they're not formally in bondage, they just ran away from their masters at some point in time. And because their ancestors were slaves, they must also be slaves by transitive property. And the notables at Al-Azhar, they basically gave Ismail an affirmative response.
Uh-huh. You know, this is also kind of interesting parallel here, because, you know, just as we're talking about how religious violence was accelerating on both sides of the Straits of Gibraltar in the 15th and 16th century, here now in the 17th and 18th century, you're seeing enslavement of African people ramping up both in Morocco and in European possessions in the Americas at the same time. That might be just a coincidence, but I also have to wonder if it's something to do with maybe a continental expansion of the slave trade. I don't know. It's very interesting.
Oh, no. I think it's a very direct connection. In fact, let me give you one concrete example. Many of these black people, they were descendants of slaves who had been brought to Morocco to work on sugar plantations, because before Europeans figured out how to do that on a mass scale in their American colonies, Morocco was the main source of sugar. And so you had slaves in Morocco doing the exact same kind of work that they would be doing in hells on earth like Haiti.
That is not, that's definitely an unpleasant thought. No, it's like, and this is one of those things where it's like, you know, it's so fun to dive into history, but like, there is just so much suffering across the past. And just imagining, like, so many people just being kidnapped from their homes, people who were legally free, even in the context of a society where slavery was tolerated. It's very scary to think about. Do we know how many black people in Morocco would have been enslaved around this time?
According to the government registers, there would have been something like 220,000 black people who would have been enslaved, which made up something like 5% of the population of Morocco.
And that also makes me think that like an 80,000 person army is actually not that hard to imagine then, if it's out of that massive of an enslaved population.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. It's called an army, but they were actually doing many different things. They were warring, sure, but they were also the people who were doing the administration, much like the Janissaries.
Oh, just like the Janissaries. Or yeah, or like the, in Egypt, what were they called?
The Mamluks.
The Mamluks, thank you. Yes, yes. So that's interesting. And you know, one thing I read when I was looking about much later European interactions with Morocco is that just as the Europeans were... Because the Europeans brought their own racial hang-ups with them to North Africa, they were uncomfortable with many of the really prestigious roles that individual black people had in Morocco. I wonder if this is sort of how that might have started, this tradition of African people being involved in administration as part of the army.
Oh yeah, but here's the real kicker that people with a Western conception of how race works are going to be baffled by. Ismail himself, you know, the guy who ordered that all black people be enslaved, he himself was half black. His mother was a black slave. Yeah, but because descent was counted patrilineally, he didn't consider himself to be black. He thought he was Arab.
That's wild. Wow.
Yeah, the past, it's not a fun place sometimes. But in any case, even though Ismail was really great at enslaving people, he wasn't quite that good at administrative techniques. The administration of Morocco remained largely very small and heavily reliant on the military, as I said previously. But thanks to the might of this army, he was able to collect taxes on a massive scale. So that meant that he suddenly had a lot more money than any of his predecessors in quite a long time would have had at their disposal.
Which is probably the most important thing if you want to, you know, maintain a strong government back then, or even today.
Yeah, and to raise further revenue, he also expanded piracy quite significantly, getting himself involved personally. I believe that something like half of the Moroccan pirate fleet was the personal property of the Sultan. So, yeah, so anything that they captured would go directly to the treasury, basically.
Yeah, wow. I can't endorse the slavery, but I do have to endorse any king who is involved in piracy.
Yeah. In addition to that, he reinvigorated relations with Timbuktu, which formally remained kind of affiliated with Morocco, even though in practice they were mostly left alone to do their own thing. But they had pledged allegiance to the Alawites once they came to power. So this was a connection that was rekindled under Ismail. And because he wanted to facilitate the trans-Saharan trade and to source more slaves as well, he reinvigorated those connections. But thanks to his efforts, Ismail was able to get the jihad going because he was able to capture several ports from the Europeans. Tangier and La Roche, among others, were back in Moroccan hands after hundreds of years. Melilla and Ceuta remained in Spanish hands, as they are to this day.
And yeah, as they are today. Yeah, yeah. I think it's kind of funny how, like, you know, Spain understandably wants the British to hand back Gibraltar, which is basically a British colony, but they do not have any interest in giving these cities back to Morocco, which I find very funny.
That's what rulership is all about. You're constantly holding people to standards that you yourself won't abide by.
Well, yeah, you know that, of course, you mentioned earlier that this dynasty was especially associated with their rulership of the city of Meknes. What, isn't there like a famous legend involving the early Alawis in Meknes?
Oh yeah, yeah. They say that in the times of Ismail, because he was collecting so many taxes, you basically had gold bars going up all the way to the ceiling in one of the rooms of the palace. So it was during this reign that the Mekhsen became synonymous with the state writ large. The word Mekhsen means storehouse or treasury. And we have it in Romance languages today in the word for store in French, magasin.
Oh, whoa. That is interesting. We talked about a while back how Almohad gave us the Spanish word for pillow. It's really funny, man. These Islamic dynasties love giving us words for either furniture or stores.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of fun Arabic vocabulary in European languages. But in any case, although Ismail was able to get the state working for the first time in quite a while, his was a very autocratic form of rule. So basically everything depended on him as an individual. There were no institutions really to keep the Moroccan state working, even if something were to happen to the Sultan. And to add to the trouble, Ismail was infamous even in his time for having so many sons. He had over 500 sons and probably as many daughters. And naturally, although he was able to rule for a very long time, he's mortal just like the rest of us.
Let me make sure I got that right. You said he had 500 sons and 500 daughters?
Yeah, yeah, pretty much.
Did they go by numbers? How do you do Thanksgiving like that?
It's complicated. I'm not sure how it's worked in the Moroccan context, but basically in the Ottoman context, which is probably the closest parallel, basically every woman was allowed to have one son by the Sultan, and then like they'd be cut off. And then once the Sultan died, the sons would fight for the throne.
Of course, yeah. So is that what happens when Ismail dies?
That and more. Much, much more.
Well, please tell us.
So when Ismail died, as eventually all of us must, because unfortunately we're not gods, there was a large number of civil wars throughout the country. He had so many heirs, so many potential claimants to the throne. And again, Bedeke passes within the family line. So like, if you have Bedeke, then presumably your sons might have Bedeke as well, which isn't really a recipe for success, really. The son who would finally end up succeeding him after all of this was said and done was Abdullah, who was mentioned in the quote that Liam read a bit earlier. Abdullah, he's an interesting case because he himself would personally be deposed and reimposed on the throne 5 times. And as luck would have it, the Abid al-Bukhari would play a central role here. Even though they worked as a stabilizing force during the lifetime of Ismail, as tends to happen with these slave armies, eventually they got a mind of their own and they decided that since they have power, they can be kingmakers, literally.
Right, right, right. Yeah, it's like the Praetorian Guard in Rome.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the midst of all this chaos, naturally tax revenue evaporated. And if you don't have tax revenue, you don't have money to pay soldiers with. So these Abid al-Bukhari suddenly found that they were out of luck and they would basically start rampaging through the countryside to steal enough to eat. Although, of course, I'm sure some of them were much less noble and were stealing much more than they needed to eat, but regardless.
Yeah, just to get rich, yeah.
But regardless, there was a lot of them, as I mentioned previously, so whichever of Ismail's sons they chose to be on the throne would reign. Because of this, between 1727 and 1757, there would be 7 different sultans on the throne, each placed and deposed at their will, more or less.
Which sounds a lot like Egypt at this time under the Mamluks. It's these constantly fighting cliques within this giant slave army running the government.
So Moulay Abdullah, he was able to regain power by ultimately allying with the tribes and knocking the Abid al-Bukhari down a few pegs. Because again, at this point, Many of them had deserted because they didn't have a salary anymore. There was no reason to stick around. But the ones who did remain, they still were able to place the king on the throne.
Right. And I guess also in this case, you know, deserting probably meant escaping slavery from their perspective.
Abdullah, when he finally retook power for the last time, former members of the Abid al-Bukhari and presumably black people writ large, because again, all black people in the country more or less were conscripted to be part of the slave army, were now being robbed and even re-enslaved by the tribes with impunity.
Oh man, that's awful.
So finally, after this literal 30 years war, it's back to the status quo ante. Abdullah would serve one final term, from 1748 to 1757, at which point he was peacefully succeeded by his son. And as luck would have it, he only had one son, so thankfully that wasn't really much of a problem. And that son, he would be the Sultan Muhammad III, considered one of the greatest sultans in Moroccan history.
All right, and we're going to talk all about Muhammad III next week in our next episode. This whole Moroccan project ended up being way longer than we expected. It was going to start as one episode, now it's going to be like two or three or four, but it's a really fun topic. Next week, we're going to go over the later history of the Alawis, eventually leading up to the period of European contact and eventual conquest of Morocco. That next episode is also going to go over some really fun topics, such as the famous Barbary pirates. We're going to really go in depth to see how they connected Morocco to other parts of the world, and also go over the ways that Muhammad and his successors would turn this very medieval kingdom, which was, you know, reliant on an army of slaves, into a modern state with professional institutions and a much more modern sort of proto-industrial economy.
And we're going to learn all about taxes, so all of you political economy heads, be prepared. It's going to be a good one.
Well, all right. Well, thank you so much, Rush and Sam, for bringing us this great episode tonight, and we will see all you guys next week.